Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Health Sector Management Program at Boston University School of Management and the American Council on Germany. Speaking will be Dr. Stefan Winter, Professor of Medicine and Secretary of State for Labor, Health, and Social Affairs, Ministry of Labor in the government of North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's largest state. Introducing Dr. Winter will be Health Sector Management Program Faculty Director, Professor Mark Allen. Professor Allen.
Dr. Stefan Winter, who's come all the way from Germany, is a professor of medicine, and since 2005, he has been serving as Secretary of State for Labor, Health, and Social Affairs in the government of North Rhine-Westphalia in Germany. With a population of 18 million, North Rhine-Westphalia is the most populous of Germany's 16 states, and if it were an independent country, it would rank fifth in the European Union in terms of GNP, and 15th internationally ahead of Russia and the Netherlands. It's a very substantial responsibility. Dr. Winter has compiled an impressive list of professional accomplishments and has held leadership roles both in Germany and internationally since completing his medical studies in 1987. His research interests include applied health policy, prevention and health promotion, biomedical ethics, medical law, and global development of new technologies in healthcare. And that's quite a range. About covers the field. He serves on the faculty of the Hanover Medical School and Harvard Medical International. He's former vice president of the European Committee for Biomedical Ethics and author of 161 publications, including 30 original scientific papers, 25 general publications, and 11 published health policy projects. This evening, Dr. Winter will address drivers of change in healthcare practice and management in the United States and Europe, and I do think we have quite a bit to learn from Europe, and some of the different ways in which Europe and America are responding to new challenges in the healthcare sector. He will focus his remarks on the social dimensions of healthcare practice and policy, and in particular, healthcare as a factor in social cohesion. Why don't you join me in welcoming Dr. Winter?
Professor Allen, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here and have the opportunity to talk to you on a topic which is rather broad. I admit it's a global healthcare challenge in the 21st century, the transatlantic perspectives, and you allow me to give you a little bit of the Northern Westphalian German European perspective, which is a focus, but then also the global question linking to the United States. So that's where I started, Medicine University of Bonn. You know Bonn, the formal capital, just to give you a range of the region. Northern Westphalia has Bonn and Cologne as cities you might know. It's located as the former Western Germany part and has been said 18 million people, whereas Germany has 82 million. And say somehow, and it has been alluded to, that it's the economic powerhouse of Europe with a quite considerate gross national product. And you can reach, as we say, 150 million consumers within a day's truck journey from our location here. So it's quite interesting, and I think it's worth a visit, and I can encourage you to do so. The economy has been said, United States number one, Japan number two, Germany number three, but North Rhine-Westphalia number 15 between Brazil and the Russian Federation. So my theory is, and we've been talking, Professor Allen and myself, briefly before, my theory is that health and wealth is really linked together, and it has been long undervalued that health is an economic giant because it links to so many fields in the social area of societies. It links to the work force, to industrial force, to innovative technologies. And if we have a good performance of health systems, we have good health. And if we good have health, we have good wealth as well. And that has then also an impact on economy. To give you a view on what my responsibilities are in Germany, it has been said it's this Ministry of Labor, Health and Social Affairs in North Rhine-Westphalia, where you have various branches. And you can easily imagine that labor is one of the branches. That's the left wing here. Then in the middle you have the health part, and then the right part you have the social affairs. And I've also started, when I came into office almost 2 years ago, an international department there, and part of our work is today's talk and to talk with you as well about topics of international health. So the basis of societies is the possibility that you have newborns, that you have people which are growing, that you have children and youth, and all this is not normal in Europe anymore, as we do have countries in the European Union which just have a birth rate of 1.1, especially the exceeding member states with now 27 European states in the European Union have a birth rate of about just one, whereas the whole European Union, as you can see in the chart here, has 1.47, which is pretty much about what Germany has. So the birth rate is really low, and it's not very very good thing to future development, because if we wanted to correct this nowadays, it's almost impossible unless we would change completely our immigration policy, which we definitely would need to. So this chart shows you about the fertility rates in the various countries. You can see we have a debate about enlarging the European Union, about Turkey, and to my point of view, part of the debate should be also focused on the fact that there's at least a high birth rate in Turkey with almost 2.5. The labor market, on the other side, is an important issue as well when it comes to health and when it comes to the idea of prosperous societies. We have in Germany an employment rate of 55 to 65 year old persons, which is in the average of the European Union states. It is not as high as we wanted it to be. It's about 45%. And you can see that in the European Union, especially the Scandinavian states, like on the right side here on this chart, Sweden and Denmark, and it's just figuring the old European Union because we don't have all the data from the new situation yet, that Sweden and Denmark do have rates of about 70% of employment rate of 55 to 64 years old persons, whereas the European Union in average has 45. And you can see also countries like Italy, which do have, due to a pension scheme wrong policy, which they have had until the year 2002, they have here a ratio of only just above 30%. That's because they allowed people to go to pension and to retire at an age of 52 for a very long time. And now the situation has changed and they changed their law, but it takes a long time in order to get back to the different schedule here, like for the Swedish situation, or at least the average situation in European Union. Just to show you your figure on the demographic development in the US, it's almost 2.1 children per woman, which is a much more comfortable situation than we do have in the European Union here. So, demographic changes and labor market developments, we have to ask ourselves, what is the contribution, what is the strategy of health and social policy here, what can we do to counter the developments we see? We do have health economy as an important factor. In Germany, we almost have 5 million people working in the health economy. In North and Westphalia, it's 1 million people. And my strong belief is that the health market itself supports job economic growth, maintenance of people in work, and gross national product growth and increase. You know the figures in the United States. You have 17% in the healthcare sector of the gross national product. In Germany, we do have 11%, and I think it's a growing rate, and it should grow. I told you more than 1 million people are working in the healthcare sector, but what is interesting for us from the labor point of view, from the working point of view, is that we estimate in the next 10 years to have an increase of 20%, so 1.2 million people would be in work, and then it's a considerable thing to look at from the labor policy as well. So what can we do to keep people in work? Like the German situation, I can tell you it's 60.4 years, the average retirement age, and the legal retirement age is about 65 years, and we now have made a law which is then completely into force, like in the year 2025, when people will go to the retirement with 67. So it's a movement towards using also elderly people in the workplace because of this demographic development I've shown to you. So what can we do? We can do a lot in terms of health promotion and prevention, health promotion at the workplace, and we have to start very early. So prevention and health promotion, to my mind, are underestimated in their positive effects on the market of healthcare as a whole. What could we do with a good prevention? We can obviously prevent the development of diseases. We can do early detection of diseases with new molecular techniques. I'll show you some of them. We could help that better coping with diseases. Once you have a disease, better coping is possible. We can prevent the early retirement of people, which is important to keep the work power in place. And obviously, the prevention or delay of nursing necessities is possible. So prevention as maintaining of good health is a good thing to follow. But it's like the savings in the bank. It's a long-term investment. And as you know, as political cycles are usually very short, like 4 years or 5 years legislative periods, we do have the situation that many governments haven't even tried to foster enough, to my mind, to foster enough prevention because it costs money. I mean, you have to save in the prevention in the first place, and then you will earn out of it in 5 or in 10 or in 15 years. An easy thing to do, and which is a heavy debate and which you have solved very good in the United States, is the tobacco debate we do have right now. And we're now in Germany at a point where in the year 2007 we might end up with a complete ban of tobacco in all public places, maybe a bit of exceptions in some restaurants, but in the general we'll have that, and it's an important thing because, you know, it's a huge weight on the healthcare system and also on the whole social system in terms of costs. So give you an example from another field. I told you the retirement, 16% in the retirement figures here are because of back pain or back pain attributed diseases, and that is just, this is a German figures, it's 25 billion euro of direct and indirect costs per year. And if we only had a 10% reduction of this figure, you would save like 2.5 billion. I'm just telling this because it's not that difficult to save that money if you have decent campaigns for the behavior on the workplace and to counteract the problems of back pain. It's like you'd use the telephone, you're standing up, you walk the stairs instead of the elevator and all this kind of stuff, which will help you a lot then. And with science, for example, in our ministry for this walking exercise, I mean, I think like 3 floors or 5 floors, everybody easily can walk. And if we and all in this room today would say we commit us to do this exercise for the rest of our life and then drink at least 2.5 liters of water or equivalent liquid each day, I would guarantee you that you would have a prolong of your life of at least 1 or 1.5 years. I mean, that's for sure, and that's not high science. So prevention and health promotion, the current political developments in Germany are that we want to put a so-called fourth column to the healthcare system, which we say comprises out of the nursing care, the rehabilitative care, the acute care, and then the fourth column, the preventive care. What is happening in medicine nowadays? Medicine, much to much, is kind of a mending. You have a damage, and then you go, the doctor goes and mends and helps and corrects, but you're not actively avoid the disease at all in advance, and that, I think, is an important thing we need to do. You know, we have examples where you can do, like the vaccination, which is very positive, and we know it for hundreds of years, and which is an effective measure, and other things like physical exercise or diets are also on, or non-tobacco smoking is also a good thing for prevention. So we need a fair distribution of financing for prevention and health promotion. We need to define and commit ourselves, which is sometimes difficult for state leaders to commit themselves to certain figures of goals and targets. For example, to say we want to have in X years, say 5 years or say 10 years, a reduction of heart infarction rate by 3%. It's a lot because it's thousands and ten thousands of people if you just get this 3% deduction, and if you don't get it, you even get 5,000. It is worth having these kind of goals, and it's like always in science, if you don't put yourself goals, it's very difficult to reach anything. So what we also would need is health promotion in settings like kindergarten, settings like schools, where it is important to have an early health education for people, but also have the circumstances that you really are able to follow up your healthy rule. What is worth my rule to climb, for example, the easy example, the stairs, if you don't have the possibility? Walk in a modern hotel, you rather will find a stair where you can walk. It will be like spider nets in the corner where you find a stair and you can't even climb, and you're people say, well, you don't go there because you do nothing, you do a wrong thing there and just use the elevator. I mean, that's reality. So what I'm going to say is that many fields in the social sector, like building, like traffic or others, they allude to health as well, and they're very important interlink. We know it from putting down the barriers we do have with respect to handicapped people in the traffic, where it is important that they can participate in social life. It's another field where we are responsible to help. For example, we're in Germany lowering the barriers for people who can't hear, because we're building now a special number so that they are able to fax if they have an emergency. I mean, this is a thing you never think about, but if someone who can't hear has an emergency, can't just take the phone and say, well, there's an emergency, but he needs to fax, and then if you have to do the 20 digits number in an emergency, it's difficult. But if you have just the 110, which is our German number for this, we put it, and it costs money. It's almost a million euro, which it does cost just for North Rhine-Westphalia. So what we do need is better quality, and we need nationwide campaigns. In a state like Germany, you need like about 10 million euro per year. Some people say 20 million euro per year, and followed up to have a sustainability of this whole effect in a campaign like the HIV AIDS campaign of about 5 million euro per year. So you'd need a sum of about 30 to 50 million if you started nationwide for 80 million people, and then you can calculate for other areas or other countries what it costs. So it is some kind of money, but it helps a lot if it is used intelligently. So is this just talk, or do we have also and already effects in the healthcare system? Yes, we do, like the effects of the working accidents in the European Union. The Commissioner Spidler from the European Union, he said very recently in a press report that the economic damage of working accidents is 55 billion euros in the European Union. That's data from the year 2000. and the effects of health prevention in the European Union could be measured. There's data from the year 2002 to 2004 that the casualties at workplace dropped about 17%. And that's due to effective health prevention and health promotion in the workplace, which has been fostered due to concerted action within the European Union. And I assume it can be figured out then also in money and savings. This picture is showing you the old guitar player by painting by Picasso. And the reason why I'm showing is that we have a change and a shift of values with respect to societal perception of the elderly people. We used to say the fit, the young, the healthy, and this is not any more guilty if it's not for the just humanity as such, where it's necessary to have this kind of a human picture of a human being. It is because also driven by the demographic figures I've shown you, it's not any more possible. I mean, it is not a very good society where not each and every part of society is valued the same, but just to clear our minds and think what the elderly people can contribute is very worth spending thinking, and we should really have a debate about this support. I've recently been to Japan, where they have a big demographic problem because they have here the figures. Life expectancy is very, very high, of about 85 with the women and about 78 with the men, and have a very low birth rate and the contradictory of about 1.2. And these people, they're now guaranteeing that elderly people the age of 65 and 60 and onwards are guaranteed to have a job in their workplace, either on a 50% basis or on a 10% basis, but they paid some money to stay in the job in order to keep the economy growing and in order to support the economic development, because they found out that if they just drop this and leave these people out of the market, they're not as good in the for example, the engineers, they have good patents with 70 year or 75 year old engineers, because they develop together with the young people, and it's a new social climate which they develop at the workplace. You can, by the way, see that the European Union and the United States and in particular Germany here are all about the same figures. Just to mention, it's the life expectancy at birth nowadays is about 81 years for the women and 75 for the men. So if you look at what the French call fin de siècle, the end of the century, and what has happened in the year 2000, many people have thoughts about the development of the healthcare system and had these global themes, as Professor Allen told my theme would be. They said, well, what will be the global future? What will be the future of health? And just to look at the epidemiological transition of the past, present, and future, you can see that the rise of infectious diseases can be seen since the year of 8000 before Christ. Then we have a decline of infectious diseases and the rise of the vascular diseases, cardiovascular diseases in the 19th and 20th century due to the hygiene on the one hand and the development of medicine and the prosperity of societies on the other hand and the malnutrition. Then you have reverse trends, the rise of violence in the late 20th century, the terrorism. Then you had resurgent infectious diseases like the HIV, the AIDS epidemic and pandemic. The SARS was an example in which you see the right picture here with the airport personnel with the masks. And obviously the influenza is a big and heavy topic nowadays, because we are in the year 39 after our last pandemic having been in 1918, 1957, and 1968. So you can see it's overdue that the H2N5 virus or another virus will give rise to an influenza pandemic with enormous costs and enormous effects on societies. So, by the way, the AIDS infection figures to show you, like in Germany, you would have 600 deaths per year, 2,000 infections per year new. Worldwide, you would have new infections, would have death about 3 million per year, and you have almost 50 million people infected. So you see, it's really a huge pandemic, and you all know, but just to give you the figures, if I count to six, one, two, three, four, five, six, after these 6 seconds, one person in the world is infected, just to give you a figure, that's dramatic, I think. Possible future epidemiological transitions, and that's about the hypes maybe of some people who thought about the new millennium, the decline of cancer, but the millennium is long, you know, and many things have happened in the past millennium, so why not the decline of cancer, the decline of dementia and other neuro diseases. It's theoretically possible, and I will talk about this in a minute, what new concepts do exist. At first and foremost, we do see an increase of dementia. For example, in Germany, a rise from 1990 to 2000, from 800,000 persons to over a million. So that's a real problem for society. Just to give you this figure, which I learned yesterday by a colleague from the European Commission when I was in a conference in Düsseldorf in Germany, together with the German health minister and the European Commission and my minister, we talked about European health. And it was interesting to see, and it's obvious that you have health policies within the European Commission, very many of these so-called general directorates. The general directorates of the Commission are kind of ministries in the European Commission. Like in the employment one, you have the open method of coordination, social protection and social inclusion. You have in the economic and financial direction, you have budgetary impact of changes in the demographic and health status. In the health SANCO, as we say, the direction, you have the health action plan. You have a research general directorate with a research program number 7 and innovative medicine initiative, which we start to have shorter innovatory cycles. You have environment general directorate with the drinking water directive. You have education general directorate with social competence as key competence of European citizens. And then not to forget the taxation general directorate with the tobacco taxation. A good example from England or the United Kingdom is that they have more than doubled the taxation some years ago, and they have by this means a reduction of a third of tobacco smokers. So, I mean, you can do a lot with money in this important field, and an action plan on drugs in the legal directorate. So you see many of the directorates are dealing with health, and health is percepted as a part of wealth because, you know, the European Union, the European Commission, all that started on the basis of economy in the first place. So theoretically, you can look at health in this circle, and then you see I've shown you the four columns, rehabilitation, nursing care, therapy, and prevention. You have a social demographic challenge, and you have technology, and we haven't talked too much about technology up to this point. To my firm view, I think we're asking doctors to perform something which is called evidence-based medicine. That means that you should only do things which you're really sure that they work for the patient, and that they help to cure the patient and improve health. And the same thing, to my mind, applies and should apply to health policy. What we would need is evidence-based health policy. And just that's difficult because it's really a mechanism which is driven by many, many forces. But also what I told you about the hypothesis and the games and the targets, the health targets I would need, it is important to set these targets and to measure the results and to benchmark them. Technology is a field which I first learned about at the University of Marburg. It's a university in Germany, in Hessen, founded 1527, one of the oldest we do have, just to show you this picture from Germany here. And technology has three dimensions. It has a dimension of the evidence, meaning does a technology work? Does it do any good to what I want to achieve? Second thing is the resources. Do I have the resources to promote a technology, to develop it, to promote it, to make production and to bring it to the market? And the third thing is what do I in society do have for values? What is the ethical part of it? And is a technology, for example, the stem cell technology, accepted? So looking at technology, we have to see some factors which contributed to the development in the medical field. The first thing was the DNA revolution. You know that the findings which we have in the genome were really tremendous, and that they have fostered the development of modern biomedicine. The total number of genes is about 30,000 to 40,000. People thought in the old days we had 100,000, but it's not that big. You know that all of the nucleotide bases in our bodies are almost alike, so 99% in all people are the same, and many of the functions are still unknown. There had been a long quarrel about, especially in the 1970s, when people talked about whether you have the effect of environment being the primary thing which would affect human beings in their well-being and in their health, or it would be the genes which would affect your health. And the answer is it's basically both. So you can have, and you know, we have vaccination possibilities for cervical cancer, for example, where you can clearly see a mechanism of a virus, the human papilloma virus, causing cervical cancer in a woman. And now we have a vaccination possibility in Germany and worldwide, and we were going to treat people and hope that we can eradicate this disease. We also know the exact molecular mechanism of this. Obviously, cervical cancer is caused by environmental factor, the virus. So it is somehow the perception in the genes, but it's also the part of the environment. And another thing which is important, we've learned the molecular mechanism. We talked about cancer a minute ago when the WHO ideas about the global health development in the third millennium were shown. The counteracting of cancer would only be possible if we do understand the multi-step carcinogenesis, the multi-step development of cancer cells, and we can show nowadays the steps, for example, for the development of a colon cancer cell, from DNA losses to gene mutations to chromosome breakages to tumor suppressor gene changes, so that you have a polyp at first, then a cancer cell, and in the end a metastasis. I did some work at the National Cancer Institute in Washington on these tumor suppressor genes, and at the Southwestern University at Dallas, Texas, USA, where my son is born, so I have also an American in my family, just to indicate this. And these two of my children are at Northfield Mount Hermon School just for this year, so there's a personal link to the United States as well. Second factor here for development, and it's underestimated to my mind, is the possibility to grow cells in vitro, in culture, so we have a chance to form cells and organ and give them directions here. Since 1953, that's possible that we do so. And a body of a human being has 50 million cells, And, you know, cells can differentiate in many organs, and they all do have, and that's important, the same DNA basis, and they differentiate due to a different onset or switching off of certain genes. So we derive all from this one single cell, as you see by this in vitro fertilization picture. And one of the aspects we want to achieve is the possibility of giving the cells a direction that they form organs. There is a heavy debate about the human therapeutic cloning, as you all know, and I'll show you about this in a minute, what the situation in the United States is compared to the European situation. The idea is that you get organ cells like pancreas or cardio cells for heart infarctions, or neurons if you have problems with the spine, or hepatocytes for liver cancer or hepatitis. This is an idea which in theory is possible, but which is difficult scientifically to achieve, but it's not impossible, and that's why we have to think about whether it's suitable under ethical aspects. So far, surgeons go and make organs transplantation, like in this center where I'm the head of the board, where we do have 5,500 patients and have more than 100 heart transplants each year, and which is really a huge center here. We have then the third part of technology development, the so-called biotechnology called as recombinant DNA technology. That's what I told you, a mixture of the DNA technique on the one hand and the cells on the other hand. So you're putting DNA in little circles and little plasmids into cells and let them produce, for example, factors like insulin. Everybody knows insulin for treatment of diabetes. And that's a success story since more than 20 years. And it's more than 60% of the newly pharmaceutical company developed drugs are biotechnology developed. So that's important. Biotechnology, it's a little bit of a lead of Europe here compared to the United States, but it's not much anymore. It's 1,600 plants in Europe, in the United States 1,400, Asia Pacific 700, Germany about 400, in North Rhine-Westphalia 180. So you see there's some strong part of North Rhine-Westphalia in Germany here with biotechnology companies here which are well known. But I have to admit, if you look at this, and we talked, Professor Allen and myself, about it, the origin of the top 10 medicines by worldwide sales have been 1992, was 60%, so six of them developed in Europe, four in the United States. In the year 2000, and I don't have the exact figure, we should see what 2008 now is. Well, next year we'll have them. Europe will have two, and the United States has eight. So you see there is a shift now in research and development, which is good for the United States, but we can talk about it, whether it's only a benefit or whether there are some things like a financial burden contributed to it. The ethical part of the coin is, especially in Europe, not so easy in the central European states. We have frontiers of new technologies in the healthcare sector. You all know the allocation of resources, which is a clear thing, which patient does get treatment, which patient doesn't get a treatment, intensive care medicine, whom to treat first, transplantation medicine, who gets an organ, xenotransplantation, meaning the possibility of transplanting organs from animals to human beings, should that be done and under what circumstances, then many things of organ replacement on cell biology or stem cell based, then the whole reproductive medicine, where we have now, I think, worldwide more than a million persons born with the in vitro fertilization, the artificial procreation. So since 1978, that's a dramatic development. Then the whole bunch of DNA chips and molecular medicine, the pharmacogenomics, and also the micromedicine, which is important here. Whatever medicine does, whatever technology is developed, in the center always is the patient, and that shouldn't be forgotten, because medicine is around the patient and humanity for the patient is the important thing. So I strongly believe that the professional standards which the doctors give to themselves are important here, and that they can better regulate than a state, so that's a political statement in a way, can better regulate than a state can regulate for themselves what is good for a patient, and the state has to give the framework that all is done correctly, properly, and under the right quality conditions. In Germany, we have a lack of 2,000 donor kidneys, 500 donor hearts, 500 donor livers, and 200 donor lungs each year, and you can see there is a need to do something about this situation. So what is science doing about it? You all know the answer, which is kind of difficult and difficult to accept by some people who believe it's not legal or it's not ethical to do so. Science is trying to circumvent the problem of organ donation lack by stem cell technology. Stem cells can be derived from either adult cells. So you all know these adult cells, the adult stem cells from bone marrow transplant for treating leukemia, blood cancer, which is successfully done since many, many years, and where high healing rates for children, in some cases 90% of the children can be healed by this transplant. However, if you go to embryonic cells and derive stem cells from cells at early embryo stages, there is the debate whether that should be done or not. And that's a huge one. The question, is stem cell research ethical, to my mind, is a very tense one, which decides also and cell biology and lead markets in the future. And it's not just an ethical question in a sense to use the embryo cells, but it's also what happens if you don't use the cells for the sake of patients who are deadly ill. If you do opinion polls on this, it's always easy. If you do opinion polls on the patients and their relatives, it's not so easy anymore. The same applies to xenotransplantation. So that's why we do a novel technology network on stem cells, also on the neuro part, and trying to develop this field. But I have to admit, just on the licensed cells up to the year 2002, that's 64 cell lines worldwide, and there's a debate in Germany whether we're going to open this. So what's the situation in the United States on this? The situation in the United States is somewhat difficult, at least from an international view, but maybe from a national view as well. You have the USA federal funding, which prohibits the embryonic stem cell research, which you see here on the right bar together with Germany and Italy. But you have then, on the other side, the non-federal funds, which are more than 50% of the whole funding, which allow it together with states like United Kingdom, Israel, Belgium or Sweden, for example. And then you have some states in the middle in the development with respect to Europe. So you see that there is a bias within the United States and within Europe, and we have to somehow solve it and harmonize the approaches, because it's very important to cooperate in this field. European Parliament is the one to decide on matters like this in a framework, but not on ethical matters. On ethical matters, it will be the national legislation who is the important one. In our case, it's the Federal Ministry of Health, who has, together with the Ministry of Justice, produced embryo protection law, which considers one single cell as a full human being. And under these circumstances, it is very difficult to accept then embryonic stem cell research. The Council of Europe, with its 46 member states, has produced a convention on human rights and biomedicines, where I had the opportunity to work with. And we have done in this convention a lot of regulations for the prohibition of cloning for human beings, for example, or the prohibition of germline interventions, and also protections for organ donations and in the research field. So we see here an additional need for further regulation and safety for the researchers. The fourth part, and that will be my last part in my talk, I want to focus on with respect to the development of modern technology in medicine, is this part, which deals with communication, the communication and transparency. This is the olden days of a transcript of what people write in the clinics on the ward, so to speak. This is the way, showing a book, this picture here, how persons in their studies used to learn. This is the way nowadays most people learn and achieve knowledge, and also the patients do. It's by and via the internet. So the complete change has now occurred between the doctor-patient relationship. We now do have the more informed patient, the patient who knows about his or her disease, the patient who is asking the doctor, doctor, I've read this and that, doctor, can you help me? I've shown this study can help me or potentially could help me. And the doctor, he is now in the need to follow up and to be quicker and to be really azure, like the patient. And that's a good sign. I mean, that's a really good thing. It's a quality assurance in itself if it's rightly used. And the communication part also gives some other chances for telematics. Telematics meaning that an electronic health card could be developed, where we have a big launch in Germany started in Bochum and Essen right now, where this year we have 100,000 people who are testing this electronic health card. And under data protection aspects, you have lots of possibilities here that you can have your insurance data, your drug documentations, the disease management, for example. You can have a documentation of allergies on it, and it's very, very helpful. So if I would have now a health problem here and would fall down and had my electronic health card here, one could immediately see that I have an allergy against cephalosporin, and you wouldn't give it to me, and I wouldn't have then the bad chance of having an anaphylactic shock after this and dying. So there's a chance in this, I think that's a thing we can really develop and promote. Another chance of electronics in medicine, and where you are also very advanced in the United States, is the process of telemedicine. We want to make a networking between the smaller clinics and the private practices on the one hand, which you see down here, and with data transmission go to centers of excellence, centers with experts who can really help the doctors and advise the doctors and help with diagnosis and help with treatments and tell people what to do in the front office. So we have here a real chance of saving unnecessary costs, of saving time for patients and saving time for doctors if that is elegantly done. Currently, we're launching a project which we're calling Portal Clinics, clinics which are smaller ones which shall bring high-profile medicine of an excellency to the rural citizens also, and not just in the big cities like Cologne and Bonn in our case, but also to smaller cities and villages. And by this process of telemedicine, that's easily doable. So the conclusion for the state of Northern Westphalia is we have the demographic changes, we have new epidemiological trends and developments with respect to disease pattern. We have our technological achievements and the need prevention and health promotion to support. We have limited resources, of course. We have values which are disputed in Europe, and we do have a globalization of health. So I do believe that health and wealth, these two, are strongly belong strongly together and have stronger relationships than at first glimpse one might think. That's why we want to launch an initiative, and it will be at the National Institutes of Health in Washington and Bethesda, and have talk with people there about networking. You have excellent networking, which you do in your research institute. You have excellent networking in some public health research aspect and epidemiological research. And we do want to learn from you, and maybe some things which I've shown you, you could find interesting. So the NRW Health will have policy advising tasks, applies healthcare research, translational research. It will accelerate innovatory cycles. We will have a systemized development of work and health protection. We have infrastructure of telematics, which I've shown you, and like the telemedicine, we want to cooperate with you and inside the European Union and also with WHO and support applied research projects. For example, we have big brain research project with respect to the Alzheimer's disease. And then it's a good thing to develop best practice projects also. So health and wealth in the circle of this perpetuum mobile, prevention, social demographic challenge, and technology belong together. And what I've shown you is that the global healthcare challenges, to my mind, are majorly derived from the demographic development, because someone has to finance the healthcare system, and it can only be active people in the workplace who are financing it. The progress in medicine and medical technology has to be supported maximum and has to be viewed under a global ethics and not just a local and national ethics. And we have to develop increasing health awarenesses for the economic plans and inside all the industry companies. And there's an increasing awareness in the companies that they're making their healthcare plans for healthy workers so that they can work longer. And so we can see health and wealth as an economic factor. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Health Sector Management Program at Boston University School of Management and the American Council on Germany. Speaking was Dr. Stefan Winter, Professor of Medicine and Secretary of State for Labor, Health and Social Affairs, Ministry of Labor and the Government of North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's largest state. Introducing Dr. Winter was Health Sector Management Program Faculty Director, Professor Mark Allen. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog, with help from Mike Toda and Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.